Blog Talk Radio.
Now, from the world's most famous beach, from where beach racing began, it's the Legends of Racing radio show. Live from Racing's North Turn Beach Bar and Grill in Ponce Inlet, Florida. The Legends of Racing radio show. And your host, Buzz McKim.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's okay if you clap too, Bob. Well, thank you. Back here at the North Turn in beautiful Ponce Inlet for the Legends of Racing radio show. We're going to have a heck of a neat time today. Something very unusual. When you say the word Studebaker, you don't normally think of racing, right? Well, I think you're going to learn a lot today. There was a heck of a lot of racing that had to do with Studebaker or vice versa. And what we really need is a big hand for Mr. Bob Coolidge, the foremost Studebaker racing historian. Awesome.
Thank you, Bob.
It's been a life's work for you, hasn't it, Bob?
It has. It's been going on since the late 1990s.
Uh-huh. Well, that's amazing. Now, did you just wake up one day and say, you know, Studebaker's not getting enough love? I think I'll do something about that.
No, I actually started doing some research for two older drivers when I discovered the first one was Ralph Ligori.
Oh, yeah.
I met him at a function here at Speed Weeks at Daytona and asking him questions about his stock car days in the 1950s. He said he had no record of what he had raced, the races he'd entered or how well he'd done in them. So I told him I would compile that out of Greg Fielden's books, I put a Word document together for Ralph and sent it to him. And I was working in Melbourne, Florida at that time and had met Dick Rathman, and I had several visits with Dick in his home, and he had made the same statement that he didn't have any record of his races that he had participated in NASCAR in the 1950s. And so I did the same for Dick, and in going through the race entries and the results in Greg Fielden's books, I kept noticing the Studebakers that had run, and I was interested. I have several Studebaker cars and trucks, and so I decided to put this information together, and fortunately I was able to contact several of the drivers who were still living, or at least family members who knew something about the drivers and the races, and eventually had a website, and I've done a PowerPoint program with many photographs, and these have been presented at the Studebaker Drivers Club National Meets in 04 in Charlotte, North Carolina, and 2012 in South Bend, Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Studebaker owners, they're fiercely loyal to their brand, aren't they?
Pretty loyal. What you said at the intro was absolutely correct. When you talk about racing, very few people think of Studebakers, and even among the Studebaker community, there are not a lot of interest in motorsports. There are some more drag racing and then the Bonneville Salt Flats entries. But I think people were pretty surprised of my presentation in 04 in Charlotte that there really were so many Studebakers that were raced in NASCAR stock car racing.
Yeah. Frank Mundy won two what we would call Cup Series races in a Studebaker back, I believe it was in 1951, wasn't it?
Yes, in 51, Studebakers were entered in NASCAR points races from 1949 up through 1962, with the exception of 1960. They raced in NASCAR in 1960, but not in points races. Probably the best team effort that was put together was in 1951 when the Studebaker 232 cubic inch V8 engine was introduced, and the Studebaker dealer in Columbia, South Carolina, W. Perry Smith, prepared a race car and brought it to Daytona, and it ran on the beach in February. It was driven by Mike Claypack, who was a veteran driver from Ohio, and then the NASCAR season stopped until April, and then in April when it started up again. Frank Mundy was the driver, and he primarily drove that car through the rest of the 1951 season.
It makes you wonder how far that team could have gone, too, because unfortunately, after those wins, Perry Smith was killed in an airplane crash. If I'm not mistaken, he was air flighting a patient to a medical procedure, right?
From Columbia to Chicago, and his plane went down in Indiana, and everyone on the plane, including the patient, were fatally injured. When the Hendrick plane crashed a few years ago up in Virginia, I contacted the sports director of the state newspaper in Columbia, and I reminded them of Perry Smith's crash and the impact that that had, and they weren't aware of it at all.
Yeah, Studebakers didn't really seem to be that competitive after them.
No, there were entries by other drivers. These were mostly self-funded efforts. There was never any factory participation in the stock car field. After the 1951 season of Perry Smith, the race car was sold, and it was run in some NASCAR races in 1952, not that competitively. A driver by the name of Billy Carden from Atlanta, Georgia, bought the car, and there were others who drove it.
Yeah,
and
then
it went to Birmingham, Alabama, and was raced as the Birmingham Club car.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. Talking about some of the drivers, that Mike Klepak that ran for Perry Smith, he won the first three sportsman championships. That would be considered the Xfinity Series now. I think it was 50, 51, 52. Mike was a powerhouse. And he ran a little bit of NASCAR. Then he went to the Midwest and ran ARCA and AAA, stuff like that. And then you mentioned Ralph Liguori. Everybody who's on the inside knows him as Ralphie the Racer. He was a great driver, but he couldn't make it at Indianapolis. I think he tried for like 20 years to make the Indy 500, never could quite make the field. Right. And then Dick Rathman, he was the brother of Indy 500 winner Jim Rathman, but he was actually Jim Rathman. Jim was Dick Richard, and he wanted to go racing, and he was too young, so he borrowed his brother's ID, and he instantly became Jim Rathman. And then Jim Rathman became Dick Rathman, and it was just too complicated to ever straighten it out. So, you know, this is how it is. Everybody knows Jim. Everybody knows Dick, and not the real story. So, but colorful people all.
They really were. Referring back to Frank Mundy and his two victories, one of his victories, the last race of the 1951 season, was at Mobile, Alabama, and that's in all of NASCAR history at the cup level, there have been around 3,000 races run, and only 70 times has a driver had the pole position, led every lap in the race, and won the race. And that was one of those 70 times that Frank Mundy did. That was his last run in a Studebaker.
I'll be darned. Yeah, Frank was quite the colorful character, too. He claimed he had $1 million wardrobe. Remember that?
Right. Now, he was always very well dressed.
Oh, yeah. And anytime he'd show up in Daytona for the Legends functions, he always had this bright red blazer, and he'd make sure he danced with every grandma on the whole place. He was great.
Couldn't miss him.
Yeah. And the first race he won with the Studebaker was at Columbia, South Carolina.
Right.
That was the first night race for the Cup Series.
Right.
First time they ever ran. So the Cup Series came out in mid-49. So this was 1951. That was their first night race.
Yes, that was the home track for Perry Smith, since he was the Studebaker dealer in Columbia. And the dealership building is still standing, or
really?
At least it was a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It has been morphed into an accounting firm's office, and it's on Gervais, which is one of the main streets in Columbia, U.S. Highway 1, and it was within sight of the state capitol building.
Yeah, I think Gervais goes right past the state capitol. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Now, some of those Studebakers, I think, had kind of filtered down, and I know there was an organization in Georgia that Jack Smith drove for, and Jack drove a Studebaker to a lot of success. Wasn't a NASCAR deal, but they were just really nice, strong, powerful cars, you know?
That's correct. There were a lot of Studebakers that were raced around the country by independent drivers in various venues. that we don't have records of, unfortunately, unless you had time and effort to go back and study every newspaper that was published in those decades.
Yep. But now the Studebaker factory realized the importance of racing even back into the 1930s, and they put together a multi-car team that ran the Indy 500.
That's correct. The owners at Indianapolis were concerned in the late 20s that the only engines being raced were Duesenberg or Miller engines, but they were all-out race engines. And they opened it up. It's called the junk formula time through stock engines. Let me check my records here.
Yeah, it was during the Depression. Money was awful tight. And, you know, Indianapolis was just hoping to get anybody to enter a car. So they called it the junk formula, meaning you could pretty much run whatever you wanted to. So you had a lot of very interesting combinations of engine and chassis back in those days.
Yes, during the 1920s, Studebaker had sponsored a car driven by Earl Cooper that was a Miller engine-powered car and a racing chassis, and Earl had been pretty successful. And then when they opened it up to the stock engines from various manufacturers, Russell Snowberger put together a car called the Russell 8, and then this was in 1930, and he was quite successful as a competitor. Then there was a group of engineers from Studebaker that on their own put together a car called the Romthy Special, and that name was derived from the first letters of each of their last names.
Really?
And then following that, the factory put together four cars, and they had a factory team, and the Studebaker 8s were raced at Indianapolis through 1936.
Hmm. I'll be darned. And one of them still survives, doesn't it?
Yes. There's a gentleman in Massachusetts who's building a replica. It's taken him several years of one of the original race cars, but there's actually one of the cars at Indianapolis in the museum, not always on display, unfortunately, but there's another one in California and one in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
So most of them have survived. The Indy cars had a much longer shelf life than the stock cars seem to have.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, a number of years ago, one of the Indy cars ran the Pikes Peak Hill Climb.
True.
And they were just tough old birds. And, you know, very interesting about Studebaker, they didn't start with the automotive industry. They go way back. How far back does that company
1852, because in 1952, they celebrated their 100th anniversary as a vehicle corporation. The Studebaker brothers started in business building push carts for the gold rush in California, This developed into building wagons, and many of the Conestoga-covered wagons were Studebaker built, and they built a lot of vehicles for various militaries around the world.
Mm.
They manufactured horse-drawn vehicles up through about 1917, and then that division was sold to a firm in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Yeah, it's. I understand that they supplied a lot of the wagons used in the Civil War, too.
That's true. Yes, that's correct.
A lot of your early cars had right-side drive for the driver, and that occurred because most of your early manufacturers had been in the horse and buggy era and building wagons and things, and the driver of the team of horses would have to sit on the right side to make sure that the horses didn't run them into a ditch that ran along most every road. So they were already set up for right-hand drive. And so when they started building cars, that's why a lot of your early cars have right-hand drive to them. How about that? You can impress your friends and maybe win a few bar bets with information like that, don't you think? Most definitely. And then there was kind of a lull in Studebaker activity. And that all ran almost into a fever pitch when Daytona Speedway was built in 1959.
Huh? Yes, when the Speedway opened in 59, there was a Studebaker Lark run in the first Daytona 500. This was a car out of Dayton, Ohio. It was driven by Harold Smith, and the car and engine had been built by Bobby Korn. And they had several races for the also-ran types. And Harold Smith started on the pole in one of the consolation races and led a lap and stayed on the lead lap all the way through the end of that race, which wasn't that long. It was only about 10, 15 laps. Yeah. It was a pretty short event. I've tried to make contact with Bobby Korn and unfortunately was not able to. And shortly after he passed away a few years ago, an article came out that the engine they ran in that 59 Lark was actually 340 cubic inches, which was a larger V8 than Studebaker had ever built. And I checked with one of the technical people in the Studebaker Drivers Club, and he said that, in fact, the engine could have been increased that much, and that when Studebaker ceased building engines in South Bend, they had some 340 cubic inch V8s under development. My guess is that that car, being about as aerodynamic as a brick, there was no concern from the inspectors that it was any danger of winning anything. So they probably didn't check too closely to see that the engine was a little bit larger than anything they were offering to the general public.
One of our old mutual friends is no longer with us, a fellow named Walt Keller, built a replica of that 59 Studebaker Lark. That was a neat little car. It was kind of a compact thing. Harold, on the other hand, was a rather large fellow, so it was an interesting combination.
Yeah, Harold was a very good driver.
Yes.
He was an ARCA champion a year or two after that, I believe.
And he ran open wheel, too, as I recall.
Right.
Yeah, very neat. Very interesting.
But then in the modified series, the aerodynamic coupes that were built at Studebaker in the mid-50s, 53, 54, 55, that it became apparent after the first year of racing the old coupes on the track in the modified series that they were not very aerodynamic and really weren't suited for high-speed racing.
Yep.
And so the entrance decided to look into using the streamline body.
Oh, yeah. If we can hold it right there just for a minute. Hey, folks, we'll be right back after a commercial break.
The caution flag is out. Time for a break. We'll be right back with the Legends of Racing radio show. Welcome to Homewood Suites by Hilton in Daytona Beach. You're right in the middle of all the action. Daytona International Speedway, the airport, One Daytona, Florida's newest entertainment and retail destination, and of course, the world's most famous beach. You'll love our newly remodeled one- and two-bedroom suites, along with our popular King Studios. You won't need your full kitchen, as Homewood Suites Daytona serves up complimentary breakfast and evening social. It's like home away from home. Go to homewooddaytona.com for Homewood Suites by Hilton in Daytona Beach. We're back from where it all began, racing's original North Turn Beach Bar and Grill. The Legends of Racing radio show continues with your host, Buzz McKim.
Thank you very much. Very much. Is that right side up? Oh, good, good. You're coming along just fine. you put an arrow on the back. Beautiful. Yeah, hey, Homewood Suites, Patrick Sullivan, the manager there, he is one of us. He grew up in racing and loves racing folks, and great location, beautiful building. Their complimentary breakfast is, I'd put it up against any breakfast in town, really. You really get your money's worth when you go there. But we were getting into the aerodynamic body style. Like this right here, this is a, what would you say that is? A 52?
That's a 1952 Starlight Coupe Studebaker.
Yep. And the back window is really cool, isn't it? Got all kinds of. We had one when I was a kid. I remember my dad and I rode down to Langhorne one time to see a race. We lived in Valley Forge at the time. But Raymond Loewy, the great industrial designer, had designed that body, and it just looks like a race car. You know, when you figure what everybody else was putting out in 52, this is a slick-looking machine right there. Did it come standard with a V8?
No, that the Starlight Coupe was offered in the Champion as well as the Commander series, and the Champions were six-cylinder powered, and the Commanders had the V8 as an option in it.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have both.
Well, when they had the opening of Daytona Speedway, you had the sportsman cars, which are similar to, you know, what you have now with the Xfinities, where you had to run the engine that came in the car and all that, and you were restricted in that regard. But in the modified division, you could run pretty much anything you wanted. So these guys were coming up with these really neat, slick, low aerodynamic bodies and putting all kinds of wild engines in them. They had some pretty weird combinations, didn't they?
There were the main thing that was Studebaker related in the modified races in the 1960s was the body. There was one or possibly two Studebakers that were actually run on Studebaker chassis and with Studebaker engines. These were out of Georgetown, Delaware. But the other cars, there was a variety of engines, Mopars, Fords, Chevys, Pontiacs, you name it, and with all sorts of frames underneath them.
Crazy. Oh, we have a caller on the line here, Bob. Yeah, we're going to run off here into the great ether and find out who's on the telephone here.
Jack Ingram.
Jack Ingram. Whoa, Jack Ingram, NASCAR Hall of Famer. Five-time NASCAR champion, first Busch Series champion, and just you could be mean as a snake sometimes, couldn't you?
Yes.
Well, you know, everybody calls you Iron Man Jack Ingram. I mean, obviously, the years you ran, you were the toughest out there and among the winningest drivers ever, held the record for the Busch Series wins for a number of years. How did that nickname Iron Man Jack Ingram come about?
Well, we ran what is now called the Xfinity Series.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody seems to want to recognize that that was what it was.
Yeah, NASCAR Hall of Fame does, though.
Yeah, but you didn't a few minutes ago.
Oh, well, I was fixing to. You beat me to it.
Okay. But anyway, this started in 30th of August. I run six races, 1,650 laps, five different states. And I'll give a run now. I got a ledger here. Mm-hmm. To South Carolina on the 30th of August, which is Thursday night. Bells won that race. Bells from Maryland on Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
Finished second in that 250 lap race. And then September the 1st, which is Labor Day, we'd been in Coburn, Virginia, and I won a 300 lap race, champion, national championship. St. Paul, Minnesota, Maryville, Tennessee on Sunday, won a 300 lap race. St. Paul, Minnesota. September the 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
I finished fifth in a 500 lap race.
Mm.
And September the 3rd again, it was in Nashville, Tennessee that night.
Oh my gosh. Holy
and
cow.
All them races were championship points.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that certainly did help you get that championship. What was it, in 73? 1973, yeah, three-time NASCAR late model sportsman champ, which became the Busch Series later on. But, you know, you were really one of the guys that helped put that series on the map. So you ran, what was it, six races in 5 days?
Yes, 1,650 laps in competition.
Son of a gun. One, two.
Almost missed the Nashville deal. They had the cars on the track.
Uh-huh.
Running when I got to the speedway.
Yeah.
I got a cab at the airport.
Uh-huh.
I was going to run his clock up, and I told him I'll show you which way to go.
Uh-huh.
I put my uniform on in the cab, went through the tunnel in the Nashville fairground, and the guy that qualified the car had to get out.
Yeah.
I raced there that night.
Oh, my gosh. Man, so you went from...
It was 200 laps.
Amazing. So you went from Tennessee to Minnesota, and then back to Nashville within, what, 24 hours, I guess, huh?
Yes.
Man, oh, man. So that's where the name Iron Man came from, right?
Yes.
Would you have a tough time doing that today?
I couldn't have done it. Yeah. I don't know if I could have done it over the next day.
Yeah. I don't know if any of the kids today could handle that sort of thing. I mean, everybody's so pampered nowadays, you know, but... well, you sure set the standard for that division. And it certainly did pay off with induction into the NASCAR Hall of Fame, and we couldn't be more proud to have you a part of it. Really neat. Anything else you want to leave us with?
Well, I had a bad accident December the 2nd, mm-hmm. and I've never really fully recovered.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a voice problem that I didn't have before,
yeah.
but I'm doing all right.
Yeah, well, you sound great, and we saw you on TV Sunday at the Southern 500. You were there with the other Hall of Fame members up there on stage, and people still love you, and they still remember you. We're going to do everything we can to keep that name out there, too. And we sure thank you for coming in, you know, being on the show today. It really means a lot to us. You've actually honored us with your presence.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Have a big round of applause for Jack Ingram, 5-time NASCAR champ. Much obliged, Jack. Wow, that's a heck of a weekend. Amazing. So I don't know if Jack ever ran a Studebaker or not.
Not that I know of.
No, no. But they were, what's the wildest engine you heard them putting in a Studebaker?
Well, probably in the modified series was the 430 cubic inch Ford engine that was used in the Lincolns and the highest level Edsel. And Larry Flynn from Holly Hill, Florida, raced one of the Studebakers with a Edsel V8 430 cubic inch, and I don't think he finished too well. I
no.
think he had a mishap and
yeah.
ended up upside down.
Yeah,
but
it was kind of rolled into a ball, actually.
But he was a strong competitor while it lasted.
Oh yeah, we have a question from the audience. Is Bob here? Bob has a heck of a good question here, and it's something that I hadn't even thought about. But if anybody would know, this Bob, Studebaker Bob, would know for sure. Here he is.
I was curious if you ever ran any Atlanta Studebaker attempts, like when Chrysler and Ford and Chevy did on the beach way back in the...
Yes, there were many Studebakers that were entered in the speed records, and there were several 56 Golden Hawks that were run, and one hit 128 point something. I can't remember the exact after the decimal point, but. There was a driver from Lansing, Michigan that was quite good in that. And in fact, there is a member of our Studebaker Drivers Club chapter who lives in Merritt Island down here that has a 56 Golden Hawk that he personally raced in the speed trials.
Wow,
here.
Really?
That has kept the same car. Surely.
Appreciate it, Bob. Thank you. I see you got your Ray Fox hat on.
Yes.
Yeah, our mutual
Ray,
hero.
It was a real privilege to become acquainted with Ray Fox in the last few years. Unfortunately, Ray's passed on, but he lived up to about 98, so nothing lasts forever, as they say. I met Ray the first time in the spring race at Bristol in 1963.
Really?
When he was running, he was preparing the Chevrolets with the 427 in it. I'm sure Ray wouldn't remember me. He was on one side under the hood, and I was on the other. But we chatted briefly after the race was over.
Yeah, he was quite a guy.
Ray actually was a mechanic at the Studebaker dealership here in Daytona Beach.
Really?
And it was called Kiker Motors, and it was up near where the archives used to be on Below Road.
Is that right?
And... Ray worked there, and they got paid on piecework, and he was doing about 5 times as much work as their other mechanics were able to do.
Yeah.
And the owner came to Ray one day and said it was causing a lot of dissension, that Ray was making all the money, and that he would prefer Ray to find different employment. Mm-hmm. And so it was at that point in time that Ray went over to Fish Carburetor and really got started. And I have a photograph of Ray in a uniform from Kiker with the Studebaker emblem.
Really?
Which was very interesting.
So he just packed up his tools and just drove right up the Blue Road,
right
up to the Fish Carburetor
right.
shop. Yeah, well, I don't know about you, but I think that Ray Fox belongs in the NASCAR Hall of Fame. What do you guys think, huh?
Yeah.
Ray Fox, definitely Hall of Fame material. Absolutely. Yeah, well, we're going to take a break for just a minute. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
The caution flag is out. Time for a break. We'll be right back with the Legends of Racing Radio Show. Racing's original North Turn is our broadcast headquarters. If you're looking for a good drink, great entertainment, and the best in food, they're right on the beach at Racing's original North Turn. Rhonda and Walt invite you to come on down to dinner tonight. Here are a couple of testimonials. These are actual testimonials from people who have enjoyed the North Turn. Been there many times, always great food and drinks, great location on the beach. And another, what a great experience. It's my new favorite restaurant in the Daytona Beach area. Racing's original North Turn on South Atlantic Avenue. That's A1A in Ponce Inlet, about 3.2 miles south of the Dunlawton Bridge and A1A intersection. It's Racing's original North Turn, a restaurant, museum, bar, gift shop, live music. That's Racing's North Turn. Racing's North Turn has been voted by you top 10 beach bar 7 years in a row. Next year, they're going for top five. We're back from where it all began. Racing's original North Turn Beach Bar and Grill. The Legends of Racing radio show continues with your host, Buzz McKim.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're here at the Great North Turn where the food is awesome. The people that are friendly. And I won't say they'll give stuff away, but you never know. You know. So anyway, and we're here with Studebaker Bob. Studebaker Bob Cool. Do you mind if we call you that?
No, that's fine.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
I've been called a lot worse.
Before we move on, I got to talk about this little picture here behind me. This is a 69 Camaro that a good friend of mine owned, a guy named Pete Earl. He was from Germany. He and I went to school together here at the Daytona Beach Community College years, 114 years ago. And then he had this Camaro here, and then he moved back to Germany, and then a dear friend of ours, she got to meet Pete when he was here on vacation one time, and they kind of fell in love. And boy, before you know it, she was on her way to Germany, and they got married. They got married in Victory Lane at Daytona, and life was fantastic. And a few years ago, Pete passed away really suddenly, and our friend Danny has moved back from Germany since then. And she gave me this picture. There's a mate to it too that I did for Pete, and it's all it is black charcoal paper with white pencil, and I like the effect, and turned out pretty neat. I was really happy with it, and I was thrilled to death to get those back for my collection. Miss Pete, I wish he still owned them, but it was just a pretty neat deal that worked out here. So anyway, enough of the commercial. Tony, you have a question for Bob.
Lower the streamline car with a center steering wheel.
Right.
And he said that when it raced, they had a hymn built by Don Barber.
Well, it had a 426 Mopar V8 in it, and it raced in 63, 64, and 65 at the Speedway in the modified races. That car is owned by Bud Layton, who lives in White, Georgia. And the car was originally sponsored by Ed Fuchs, who had a bakery in St. Louis and in Miami, Florida. And it's probably the only surviving vehicle from the modified races in the 1960s. Bud, someone clued Bud in that the car was for sale on eBay, had been put up for sale, and it was in St. Louis. It had no engine in it. And Bud and his two sons bought the car, and they've reinstalled a 426 Mopar engine in it. And the car has been kept in original race form. In fact, I think it still has the same tires on it that it ran on at the last time at the Speedway. It is a center steer car, which is somewhat unusual. It's the only one I've seen personally of that. And I don't know the frame under it. But it probably was not a Studebaker frame. But the car was driven by Red Farmer in 1963, mm-hmm. the first time it hit the track. The second time in 64 was driven by Bob Burcham of Rossville, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And the last time it ran, it was driven by Jerry Lawley from up in the Pensacola, Panama City area of Florida. They have in the original vehicle, they created some air escapes, and the story is that when the car exceeds 160, the back end begins to come off the ground and gets a little light. So
that's not a good thing, is it?
I'm sure that would be a thrill to whoever was in it at that time.
Check your pucker power. Yeah, and you know what's interesting about that too? The car still has the mag wheels, not the racing wheel, the mag wheels that they ran on the back of the car the last time it ran Daytona. Absolutely, it has not been restored except for getting a new motor in it, but the original paint, original lettering. Bud Layton was kind enough to let me crawl into it, and I got to tell you, you don't want to be in a hurry to get in that car. I mean, if it was on fire, you'd find a way to get out, but you have to be a contortionist to get in that darn car with the center steer. And man, I ached for 3 or 4 days. It was painful, Bob.
Well, it was very interesting to see it. I didn't try getting in it, but it was interesting to see the car. And it had been promised to be brought down the year before, and they didn't quite have it ready. And so it was nice that it came this last February to the parade here on the beach race course.
Oh, yeah. It was wonderful. There was a fella and his wife that came to the NASCAR Hall of Fame about a year ago, just before I retired. And he wanted to chat. His name was George Parrish. And George raced in the Cup Series from 54 to 1958. And he ran 21 races, and every single one of them was a Studebaker. And he loved that brand. He loved the cars. He would have continued to race longer, but unfortunately they had a big wreck at Darlington in 57, and Chocolate Myers' father, Bobby Myers, was killed. And his wife kind of put some pressure on him to get out of racing. But he would have carried on with Studebaker as long as he could have. But he was dyed-in-the-wool Studebaker fan, and he couldn't talk to him about any other brand. And that's just how loyal those people are. Huh?
Well, George is a good friend of mine. He and I share a birthday on August 29th.
Really?
And he turned 90 and I turned 70. George is still living up in North Florida, out of northwest of Gainesville a ways. He was the Studebaker dealer in Henderson, North Carolina, which is near the Virginia-North Carolina line, right off Interstate 85. That was also where Corbett trucks were built and assembled in Florida and North Carolina. But George, he had done a lot of street racing, which was mostly illegal, but he had the racing bug, and so he built a 53 Studebaker coupe, took it to Charlotte, and Bill France Sr. inspected it and gave him the okay. And so he ran his first race there on the old original dirt track at Charlotte, where the first NASCAR race was won. And then the second race that George started was the 1954 edition of the Southern 500 at Darlington, which I think was kind of bold for someone to go from not having really raced but one race on a dirt track to the Southern 500 at Darlington. But George raced that car for about 2 years or so. He raced out of his hip pocket. He tried to get some support from the corporation, and they turned him down totally. Anyway, he quit racing. He sold that car to Blackie Pitt, who was from Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And if those of you who know NASCAR history in the 50s, you will recognize Blackie Pitt's name. He and his brother Brownie Pitt raced cars, Oldsmobiles and Plymouth. And then Blackie raced the Studebaker Hawk in 58. But George, I had never heard of George Parrish. And when I was doing the research on for these other drivers, I kept seeing his name. And I asked Marvin Panch and others that were listed as being in the same races if they knew George Parrish. And they said they vaguely remembered someone by that name, but they hadn't seen him in years. So I went on the internet, and there were two George Parrishes listed in Henderson, and I thought, well, surely he must be one of the two. And so I sent letters. I really don't like calling people cold up. And so I sent letters to both of them, and one man wrote back right away that he was not the person I was looking for, and he didn't know him. And the other person I sent didn't hear from, and I sent a second letter and didn't hear anything. And finally, one Sunday afternoon, I thought, well, I'm just going to dial them up. So I dialed the number, and an elderly female voice came on, and I thought, well, she's going to tell me she's his widow and he's no longer living. And in fact, she was not related to him, and I said I was trying to find George Parrish, who raced Studebaker automobiles in NASCAR, and she said, well, my husband was a Christian. He did not race cars.
Oh, wait a minute.
So I thanked her, and that kind of ended that. And so I contacted the editor of the newspaper there in Henderson, and he was a stock car racing fan. He hadn't lived in Henderson that long, but he said, send me a letter, and I'll publish it. And so I did, and within a few hours after it was published, I was put in contact with George up here out of High Springs, Florida. And we've had several visits, and George has been here, and he came to the 9 years ago, he came to the second Darlington Historic race event, and it was very interesting. He had not been there since he last raced there in 57.
Wow.
And he showed me exactly where the accident happened with Bobby Myers and Paul Goldsmith, where Bobby Myers was fatally injured. Mm-hmm. And has met Chocolate Myers here at one of the banquets during Speed Weeks. Mm-hmm. But George raced, and he came back in 57, and he had built a 56 Golden Hawk. It was running the Studebaker V8, not the big 352 Packard V8 that the cars originally came with. And he raced it, but he said after seeing the accident with Bobby Myers and that, his wife and two small children were up in the stands, he said he knew he needed to stop racing. And he had never won. His best finish was a 10th at the old Richmond Fairgrounds, when it was a dirt track. And he said, fortunately, he never won, or he knew he would never have given it up. But he ran through that fall, and at that time frame, the next year's season started in the fall of the previous year. And so his last race was at Fayetteville, North Carolina, at the old Champion Speedway, and that was the first race of the 1958 season. But George is a great guy, and unfortunately, I think he's going to shuffle off the scene here before too long, probably. But it's been very nice being able to visit with him and hear about what racing was like. He can recall racing with Buck Baker and others really well. So
he's a heck of a
guy. Been
nice.
Very good.
We're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back.
The caution flag is out. Time for a break. We'll be right back with the Legends of Racing radio show. At Beach Boys Embroidery and Tees, it's all about making you happy. Beach Boys Embroidery can customize your athletic golf apparel, caps, hats, badges, buttons, magnets, backpacks, bags, totes, clocks, watches, oh, and of course, T-shirts. Sure, they're at 2033 South Ridgewood Avenue in South Daytona, and they're waiting for you to call now, 386-255-5880. Beach Boys Embroidery and Tees. We're back from where it all began. Racing's original North Turn Beach Bar and Grill. The Legends of Racing radio show continues with your host, Buzz McKim.
Thank you, folks. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Here with Studebaker Bob Coolidge. And you're doing a intern, too. You're doing a heck of a job there. Yeah. You had a good instructor here. Yeah. How about this is his maiden voyage, more or less. What a guy. What a guy. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Hey, you know, viewers and listeners, they can comment on Facebook Live. Actually, we have a couple here. Ron Norton, he recommends the Legends of Racing radio show. Buzz is great. Very knowledgeable. I didn't even have to pay him to say that. Ron and I are old friends. Ron and I used to race together at the local dirt tracks. He worked for Smokey Eunuch back in the Curtis Turner days. And he and I were part of a team that went to the Baja 1000 years ago. We can't even talk about that in public. And anyway, Leon Phillips says, great show. Tom Hines says, y'all are interested in any form of these sessions. Well worth a listen. If you're not fortunate enough to know these guests personally, you get a chance to eavesdrop on some of the great stories. Thanks for letting us listen. And that's the thing, you know, we don't want to just entertain we want to educate, and we certainly are getting an education today from the Studebaker, and I don't know of anybody else that could carry the flag for that brand better than you do, Bob. Now,
well, thank you.
There was a fella from town here, I believe his name was Merritt Brown. Yeah, he raced Studebakers too, didn't he?
Merritt Brown raced on the beach in the time trials, and he also raced at Darlington and at the track that was originally built in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
He was very good here in the time trials. His cars were probably underfunded at the cup level, but because he didn't finish that high, but he was a player in the races in that era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good guy. But then, well, you talk about catching on to a good idea. The first several years that Daytona ran their modified sportsman race, which is now today the Xfinity race, you've got some stats there on the number of cars that raced here.
Well, there were really an unbelievable number of vehicles. In those modified races, they usually started 60-some cars, and so there were far more than the 38 or 40 that we see today in the cup races, or even fewer than that in the truck races and the Xfinity fields. One thing I want to bring up that many people may not be aware of, and that's the compact car races, which were held in the late 50s and early 60s. And Studebaker was very competitive in some of those races. Holman Moody in Charlotte, North Carolina, is primarily known for building Fords, but they built three Studebaker Lark race cars that ran at Sebring, and they ran at Daytona in 61 and at Lime Rock, Connecticut. I visited Holman Moody in 04 when I was in Charlotte, and Lee Holman let me look at his files and make copies of them. That Holman Moody has a file on every race car they've ever built, and it was quite a bulging file cabinet. But these Larks, they sent four cars directly from South Bend to the factory to Charlotte. One was a chase car, and the other three were built as race cars. And the first effort was sponsored by Ed Markham Down Lane, who was a Studebaker dealer in Miami Springs, Florida. And he was well known as a used car dealer, and that's where he would show cars on television back when you had local programming. You had these people that would roll cars right into the studios and show them on TV, and his name was Markham Down Lane. But anyway, they built these three Studebaker race cars, and they went to a race at Sebring, and they had a two-hour event before one of the large sports car races, and you had Curtis Turner, Fireball Roberts, and Ralph Moody were the three drivers in the cars, and their main competition was the Jaguar race team that was owned and put in place by Briggs Cunningham. And they started the race, and the Jaguar, the Sebring track, if you're familiar with it, I don't know whether you've been there or not, but it has a very level straight stretch and then a very broad bending turn, which is very high speed, and then it has a hairpin turn. Well, by the time they got to the hairpin turn, Walt Hansgen, who was driving the primary Jaguar, had managed to take the lead, and they hit that hairpin turn, and Curtis Turner threw his Lark into a huge broadslide. The Jaguars were right-hand drive, so you had drivers shoulder to shoulder, and Turner retook the lead for a while and led the race. It was quite a stunner from everything that I've been able to find out about that event from people who were there. Anyway, Hansgen was the winner of the race, and Curtis Turner finished second, and he ran the last lap with a flat front tire, but he still managed to finish. And Fireball Roberts was running right at the front, and on the very last lap, his engine blew, and he finished way back. But Ralph Moody finished in fourth place. And those were 1960 model Studebaker Larks. They were running the 259 engine. And Holman Moody built those in a month. And it really was quite an accomplishment. The cars couldn't come. Bill France staged the compact car race out here at the Speedway in 1960, but they had a 200 cubic inch size limit on the engines. And so there was a Studebaker Lark running the old 169.7 cubic inch flathead six cylinder, which was anything but a neck snapper. I've driven them, and they were not very competitive. There was a driver by the name of Bill Rydell from Fort Lauderdale who owned the cars, and he finished the race, but he was not competitive. Then they had a two- or three-lap women's national championship, and a female driver by the name of Lois Tyler mm-hmm. raced the same car, and she finished the race, and it was not too competitive. The next year in 61, during speed weeks, they took the size limit off the engines, and those cars were driven. They could run the V8s, and the race in 61 was raced in a clockwise direction on the speedway, which was the races have always, other than this one, have been run counterclockwise, but they used the road course and the track. And Tim Flock was driving one of the cars, and Jocko Maggio Como Sr. was driving the other one. And Tim was pretty competitive. Interesting, I asked Frances Flock, Tim's widow, about that race here a few years ago. And she said, no, Tim never raced a Studebaker. And I showed her a photograph of Tim driving it on the track. And she said, well, she guessed she had forgotten that one. But a few months before that, they had an eight-hour race at Lime Rock, Connecticut, and Ralph Moody entered one of the Larks in that race, and he won the race, which was surprising because they didn't think the Studebaker V8 could be run hard for 8 hours, and they won that race, and Jocko Maggio Como Sr. was his co-driver. But Ralph was credited with the win.
Well, that says an awful lot about the brand, that Holman and Moody would think enough of them to build those cars.
Well, I have copies of John Holman's letter, and he was very complimentary of the performance they could get out of them with such a short time frame to work with them.
Remarkable. That's a chapter of racing history that I believe you're probably the only one that knows about that.
Well,
that's remarkable.
The cars went back to Holman Moody, and they sat there for about 3 years unused. And Ralph Moody was driving one of them around the buildings. Their shops at that time were at the Charlotte Airport. And he came around the corner of a building at a high rate of speed and discovered in front of him that someone had moved some of the concrete parking barriers. So he went right over them at race speed, took the front end right out of the car, and they had to rebuild that. But anyway, the car sat there for about 3 years. And then Lee Holman said in 1963, they got a notice that a truck would be coming to pick the cars up. Then it went, and that happened, and the cars went north, and they've never been seen or heard from since.
Wow.
We have the serial numbers because we got copies of the production orders on them, but no one's ever been able to find any of the cars, and it's a kind of a mystery as to what became of them.
Oh, would you love to stumble upon one of those, huh?
Yeah, that would be very special.
Yeah. You know, in 1963, the modified sportsman race was won by the great Leroy Yarborough in a Studebaker. And then he was leaving the following year and got into an accident and destroyed the car. He got trapped in the car. It was on fire. And Fred Lorenzen was one of the people that came out and drug him out of the car. But that little Studebaker that was owned by Cam Gagliardi?
Right.
Boy, that thing was
Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, it was a monster. What kind of engine did they have?
421 cubic inch Pontiac V8 was what they were running. And in fact, in the 63 race, the race was primarily between Leroy Yarborough and Bobby Johns. Bobby Johns had another 421 Pontiac engine in a Chevrolet, and those two finished the race four laps ahead of the next finishers.
Wow.
And the race was pretty much between those two people.
Mm-hmm.
With Leroy getting the win and then almost losing his life a year later in the same car.
Yeah, in fact, you can see a film of that accident on YouTube.
Yeah.
And you can see Freddie come running out there in his white uniform and, you know, helping get Leroy out of the car. It was pretty dramatic, actually. In fact, the story goes that Leroy had actually, it happened right behind him, and he drove all the way around the track and got into the wreck. So he's just having an off day, that's all. Looks like we're going to break for one more commercial, and we'll be back in just a second with
The caution flag is out. Time for a break. We'll be right back with the Legends of Racing radio show. Welcome to the Janet Hale Foundation website. With this website, we hope to broaden our reach, to find someone like you to help us on our journey. Janet's journey started 40 years ago to ensure that all children had a toy under the tree at Christmas. Today, thousands of toys and clothing are donated for underprivileged kids. We need your help to continue our journey. Tour this website and find the Donate Now button. A small gesture can make a big difference in a young life. We need your help. Visit us on Facebook, Janet Hale Foundation, or call 386-256-0752. We're back from where it all began. Racing's original North Turn Beach Bar and Grill. The Legends of Racing radio show continues with your host, Buzz McKim.
Thank you, thank you. Appreciate that. Broadcasting here from the North Turn Restaurant. We're here with Bob Coolidge. And, yeah, the Janet Hale Foundation is one heck of a deal. You know, we're getting into the holiday season now, and if you think about making any contributions to any charities, there's nothing better than helping kids. And it's a great, great outfit, and I know they would greatly appreciate your help and your support. And so keep Janet Hale and her foundation in mind, okay? All right, well, we're coming down almost to the last lap here. Have you ever, well, yeah, you own Studebakers now, don't you?
Yes, I have several Studebaker cars and two Studebaker trucks. And one of my cars is a 51 Commander that is being built as a NASCAR replica of one that was raced in NASCAR in 1951.
Mm-hmm.
It has the 232 V8 and a three-speed transmission in the floor.
Now, they were popular out on the West Coast, too, weren't they?
They were, yes. This is the car this is modeled after is one like George Seeger from Whittier, California, mm-hmm. raced. It was a two-door sedan. Most of them were Starlight coupes, but this one was a two-door sedan,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I have, and that's what we're modeling this car after. George and the owner, Tony Sampo,
mm-hmm.
They were from the Southern Los Angeles area, and they flat-towed the car, and it ran at Detroit at the Michigan Fairgrounds, and it ran a couple other races, and he was the highest-finishing Studebaker
wow.
in the 51 Southern 500.
Really?
And then they flat-towed the car back to California, and they got in a dispute somewhere in Arizona, and Tony Sampo was doing the driving right then, and George Seeger came out of the restroom and found out that Tony had left with the vehicle and left him sitting on the commode in the men's room. So I got that story from Bob Barkheimer, who was West Coast NASCAR rep in that time frame.
You want to make sure you stay on good terms with the driver, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, now, if anybody out there has interest in Studebakers, if they own one, or if they want to get more information about them, how do they go about joining the club?
Well, it's very easy. The Studebaker Drivers Club has a good functioning website, and it has a membership application. The Studebaker Drivers Club is the largest single mark club in existence. It
really?
Has around 13,000 members around the world.
That's remarkable.
And there's a strong racing interest contingent from Australia because the Lark type visits. Lark type cars raced over there pretty successfully.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then they had the Avanti that went out with the Granatelli brothers and ran out Bonneville in the early 60s.
Right. Yeah. And the last Studebaker that was raced in a recognized sanctioning organization was a 63 GT Hawk that was driven by Dick Passwater, who's retired over in Bradenton, Florida.
Yeah, he'll be one of our guests here pretty soon.
Dick raced the car in ARCA and USAC stock events. He called Bill France because he had raced in NASCAR in the 50s and was a winner at the Cup level in an Oldsmobile, and he wanted to run the GT Hawk in the stocks here But since it was supercharged, Bill France said, well, he'd have to drive it without a supercharger on it, because they didn't, NASCAR rules didn't allow superchargers. So Dick stayed up north with the car, and after he finished racing it, it was returned to stock civilian use, and it was sold to someone in Texas and was destroyed in an automobile accident T-boned in Texas, and so that's the end of the car.
Holy cow.
Fortunately, I have several color photographs of it, so it's nice to have that.
Yeah.
The last car in NASCAR that raced was in 62 at Nashville, Tennessee, and the car was not very successful. They had difficulty with the fuel lines of keeping fuel pumped into it when they were on the high banks. So that ended the effort there.
But boy, what a great history. Holy cow. And you really opened our eyes up on what that brand has done. We're getting down here toward the end, and we have to say thank you to several folks. We are so blessed with the folks that we have on our team. It just kind of keeps growing and growing. And first off, we have our chief engineer, Shane Stanton, the Bolt, right? Yeah. We have Richmond Carter, intern number one. There we go. And then we have Mike Neumeier, or not Mike, David Neumeier, who is intern two, T-O-O, intern in training. There we go. And, of course, Leonard Marsh, the scribe, who's not here today. Do they have to clap for him if he's not here? Okay, that's good. All right. Yeah, got to show up. Our photographer, Bill Watson, the Flash back there. What a guy. Now, Elizabeth Wicks is going to be back soon. She's our social director. She's Miss Bake a Cake, so she'll be back in a few weeks. Rhonda and Walt, who own this place, Rhonda is the assistant field director, and Walt is the roadie. So we couldn't do it without them. We got to give them an applause whether they're here or not, right? Exactly. Yep, and then we have my dear wife, Gwen, who's known as Buzz Boss. I'll let you be the boss this week. And yours truly, Buzz McKim, who is just so honored to be part of this. You know, you have no idea. And then, of course, the guy who is in charge of this whole thing, Mike Multane, the head poobah and spiritual advisor. Absolutely. Yeah. And we just cannot thank Bob Coolidge enough for being here. I mean, he's a regular. We're so thankful for your support. But to share your wisdom and everything with us, the knowledge has been tremendous. And we just can't thank you enough for taking the time to put all this together.
Well,
and,
thank you, Buzz. Yeah. I'm appreciative of the opportunity.
Well, folks like you really help keep the history going, and that's what we're all about, right? Thanks. Bob Coolidge, how about that? Thank you so much. Wonderful. Yep.
The Legends of Racing Radio Show originates live from the very spot where beach racing began, racing's North Turn Beach Bar and Grill. Join us next time for the Legends of Racing Radio Show with Buzz McKim.